Good evening, everybody. My name is Greg Mittlider, and on behalf of CS50, I want to thank you once again for joining us for a Tech Talk in our series this fall semester. Tonight, we have the pleasure of having our friends from Uber with us. They're going to talk about the obstacles they have to overcome in what seems to be a very simple task by us, the user, which is how the car gets to you whenever you choose that you need a ride. Tonight, we have the pleasure of having Matthew, Yuki, and Ali. They're going to be speaking with you tonight. So without further ado,
all right.
Uber.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Cool. So today, Matt and I are PMs at Uber, product managers at Uber. And we're here to talk about how we build products at Uber, how we bridge the physical and digital worlds. At the expense of making us seem really old, we wanted to talk a little bit about what Harvard was like before the Uber days. So Matt was concentrating in English and busy doing pre-med in the beautiful house of Elliot. And I was concentrating in computer science and TFing CS50 in the superior house that is Matter.
You
did
the slides.
Yeah, I did the slides, so I got to decide. And in terms of how we got around, of course, we used the T to get into the city. I think all of you still do that. But you know, there's always the inconvenience of not being able to needing to come back before midnight. We took cabs to get to the airport. And of course, we took the Harvard shuttles to get around campus, the Matter Express being my favorite. And Matt and I liked using this to visit our sad friends in the quad who didn't quite make the cut for blocking groups. But CS50, in terms of the innovation that was happening in this transportation space, CS50 was pretty eager to make the shuttle experience better. David built Shuttle Boy back in 1999. What we did was also take this massive PDF that people had to parse to understand shuttle schedules, and we made these CS50 shuttle cards, which are these tiny little things that you could put in the wallet. We printed thousands of them and distributed it across campus. So that was the kind of innovation that was happening at the time.
They were viral.
Yeah, they were kind of viral, but we clearly weren't thinking big enough. But it was really funny. I dug up some emails with David back in the day. I was really excited about these things. And so I would ping him late at night about the Matter schedule or something like that. So something I was really passionate about. But that was the kind of innovation that was happening on Harvard.
Yeah, so that was kind of what getting on Harvard was like back when we were in school. But obviously, things have changed quite a bit. We were in school 6 years ago. There was no Uber. Today, that's not quite the case. So if you look now at a map of Harvard or Cambridge, Harvard Square, you can see each of these yellow dots represents an Uber trip that's begun. And this is just data from the last week. So we're moving quite a few people around the city from point A to point B, which is pretty cool. And if you zoom in a bit and you just look at trips that begin or end at some of the Harvard houses, this is also from like a weekend, you see that we're doing some good work bridging the quad river house divide, which as someone who lived in Elliott, I think is really sweet. Because I honestly couldn't tell you the difference between Courier and Cabot, but apparently we're making that world smaller, which is really wonderful. And if you just take a look at the count of trips by house, it's also really interesting to see some of the trends here. So there are a certain set of houses that people really like to visit, they're being dropped off at, and there are other houses that people seem to want to leave, and they're getting picked up at. So this is kind of the relative rankings in terms of where people are going and coming.
Yeah. We're a little bit unsure what's going on in Winthrop, but
not happening. And then Uber has another business called Uber Eats, which is food delivery. So you can get food delivered from a local restaurant. If you look at the number of deliveries that are being made per house, it's also really interesting to see kind of which dining halls might not be serving the needs of their students quite as well as other homes. So I don't know what's happening at Mather, but maybe Yuki can
All
right, cool. So Uber isn't popular just at Harvard and hasn't changed transportation just here at Harvard. We are in tons of cities. All over the world, and if you just look at in the U.S., these are our five biggest cities as we rolled out starting 5 years ago, and you can see there's lots of really interesting data here. One is that our growth has been almost exponential, which is pretty cool. And if you look, this is in the order with which we launched our biggest cities: so SF first, then New York, then Seattle, then Chicago, then D.C. You actually see that growth rate is increasing as we roll out a new city. So as we launch a new city, the adoption is even faster than it was in previous cities, which is pretty cool. And if you look at our trend globally, we're in tons of countries. which we'll get to in a minute. This growth is also really rapid. And we're now basically everywhere in the world you go, you can pretty much take an Uber. LATAM being our fastest growing market right now. And I'm actually going to Colombia tonight to go see what's happening with our cities there and see how we can make that product experience better for our users.
And for those of you who are observant, this is in the logarithmic scale. And so that's kind of, we had to adjust this chart to make it fit.
All right, so Uber today, 2017, we're at 600 plus cities. I think we're like 660 right now. We're in 77 countries. And as of June 29th, we hit our 5 billionth trip, which is pretty amazing. But the cool thing is these numbers are kind of changing every day and growing every day. We're expanding to more and more cities. Like just the other week, we launched a new city in Croatia on like some small islands. And actually these Ubers were all boats. So they were like contacting us, being like, we need to like, change the app to work for boats. And I was like, okay, like we can do that, I guess. But like, so there's a lot of land kind of still to be grabbed, and it's really exciting times for us.
Cool. So this all sounds really simple, and we're doing billions of rides. And it seems really simple to get someone from point A to point B. But it turns out that a lot can go wrong. And specifically, the thing that can go wrong is always alluded to earlier, which is actually getting picked up by your driver. And so if you think about the journey for a rider, you open their app, you request a car, and you get into the car. But actually, this particular part is the most difficult part. And this is where we need to bridge the physical and digital worlds. So I'm going to first talk a little bit about this period right here, which is just the period between you opening the app and requesting a car. And the first question we ask when, and all the tech that goes into making this happen. So the first question we ask is, when you open up the app, where is the rider? And this sounds like a really, really simple question, but figuring it out isn't always easy. And one of the reasons for this is because GPS is often inaccurate. And so there are many reasons that can cause this. This can be because there are tall buildings surrounding you and they block the line of sight with the GPS satellites. There can also be buildings that cause reflections that misguide us. And therefore, I think all of us have had this experience where we open up our app, whether it's the Uber app, Google Maps, and the blue dot isn't really where we're at. And these are the kinds of problems that can produce this. We have another kind of problem, which is that reverse geocoding can be inaccurate. So reverse geocoding is the act of taking a geocode, which is a lat long, these coordinates that represent where you are, and then turning it into an address. So these are the lat longs for this space. And when you reverse geocode it, hopefully what it produces is 67 Mount Auburn Street. But actually, if you look at some of the examples I'm going to show you, this can also be an inaccurate process. So it's an example. I'm not sure if any of you have been to T-Lux in the square. If you have, if you happen to put your pin right in the middle of it, then it produces the correct address, which is 0 Brattle Street. And it turns out Brattle Street is 0 index, which is pretty cool. and so that's correct. But if you move your pin slightly away from it, then all of a sudden, we think you're in 1 JFK Street. And for whatever reason, it may be because the outline of the POI, T-Lux, the point of interest, might be slightly inaccurate. It might be because it's actually a little bit closer to JFK. And this slight difference produces a different kind of pickup because the driver is going to actually show up on JFK Street, which is very different from showing up on Brattle Street, especially if you consider T-Lux, which I think only has an exit on Brattle Street. And there are many kinds of examples like this. So this is the Cambridge Side Galleria, for those of you who've been. And so if you put your pin on top of P.F. Chang's, which is a David Malan favorite, I don't know if it's changed. Then what happens is we have a selection of addresses to choose from. It could be P.F. Chang's. You're technically still inside the Cambridge Side Galleria, so we could choose to show that instead. We could also show the street address for Cambridge Side Galleria. We could show the street address for P.F. Chang's. And you can imagine if we pick any one of these, it might produce a different kind of pickup. And so this is kind of our fundamental problem, which is that your input, which is the lat long, could be inaccurate. And then the process of translating that into an address could also be inaccurate, so your output is also erroneous. So this is kind of what we're dealing with, which is kind of a difficult situation to be in. So what do we do? So some of the ways we try to solve this is actually trying to predict where you are based on the information that we have. So if you really think through the problem, and we started with some hypotheses. So for example, let's say that you recently got dropped off at Courier House. Right? And even if the GPS is telling us that you're in FoHo, we might actually believe that you are more likely to be in Courier because you just got dropped off there. So that could be an interesting heuristic to start using in terms of round trips. Or another hypothesis, and this is a simpler example, you know, if you've saved a location, so this our app has the feature of basically favoriting a location. So Mather House is a saved location, obviously, for me, both in the app and in my heart. And if even though you know, the GPS might be telling you we're not there, it's very likely because you saved it that you know, you're going to be in this location or you care about it. And so that's a signal that we can use. And when you start thinking about these hypotheses turn into what we call features, features that inform our pickup prediction model. So our pickup prediction model takes a bunch of these different kind of parameters, if you will, and basically starts to build models on top of it. So other features include trip count. So for example, I worked at the Harvard Crimson, and I spent a lot of time there. So this is the hypothetical me, because like these trips I never took. And I spent very little time in Adam's House because they didn't let me eat there. I don't know if that's still a thing. But in any case, if the GPS tells us that we think you're somewhere in between these buildings, we might actually favor the Crimson because you know you take a lot of trips there or you take a lot of trips from there. Another feature might be destination. So this is a slightly contrived example, but you know, you have this area right near Lamont where there's the Department of Comparative Literature and then there's the Barker Center. And depending on where you're going, if you're going northbound, because these are both 1A streets, we might favor the Barker Center. If you're going southbound, we might favor the other place. And another feature that's really interesting is time of day and day of week. So if you are, you know, in the weekdays, you might be going to CS50 lectures or whatever that may be. And so if our GPS tells us that you're in Annenberg, we might actually intuit that you're actually closer to Sanders. But maybe in the evenings or on Saturdays or something like that, you're in Queensland. So all of these kind of contribute to us, this model of figuring out where exactly you are. And we're experimenting with a lot of them all the time to make it smarter and smarter.
Okay, so we've talked a lot about like figuring out where the rider is when they open the app, which is pretty awesome. But in order to like, make a trip actually happen, we need to get a car to you. And so I work on routing, and one of the big problems is that like where humans are isn't necessarily a place where a car can actually reach you. So we have this problem, next slide, where like even if we know where you are, that doesn't mean that's the best place to actually get picked up. So we need to then translate the place where you are, which we've decided now, where we've helped to intuit, to a place that a car can actually go. Next slide. So we're going to keep going. So let's take an example. This is an airport. This is actually the airport in Dallas. And this is an image taken from 2 years ago. And what this is depicting is a bunch of trips, where every trip is represented by 2 points and a line. 1 point is the location where the rider was requesting to get picked up. So they get off the airport, or they get off the plane, they're like walking through the food court, and they're requesting to get picked up. I want to get picked up at the airport. The second dot is where the trip actually began. So what you can see is that people were asking to get picked up all over the airport, at the food court, at the luggage, I mean, when they're picking their luggage. Some people were even requesting a car from like in the plane on the tarmac, which is impossible. Cars can't go to any of those places. So there's this coordination that has to happen where then the driver has to call you and be like, where do you actually want to get picked up? Like, I can't go to the food court. And the rider has to be like, oh, I guess somewhere near departures, or maybe I'm not from here, I don't know where to go. It's very, very messy, right? But you see that most of the actual pickups will happen somewhere along this row, which is you know where departures are and where you can actually arrivals are, and you can actually get a car into this space. So what we did is we said, okay, this is problematic. And there's a team in Dallas. Every Uber city has an operations team that works there, and they're local. We can go to them and say, hey, look, you guys live in Dallas. You know your airport. We don't know your airport. Can you tell us where at the Dallas airport like people should get picked up? And they're like, yes, of course we can. We fly here all the time. These are the 5 spots. And so what we did is we actually mapped out all the places at the airport that someone can get picked up, and actually we indexed it by terminal, which is pretty cool. And so we launched this, and what this does is it cleaned up the space where people were actually requesting. So now when you land at the airport, we figure out you are at the airport using what you get just described, and then we'd say, okay, you can only get picked up and request a ride from one of these select places. And that simplifies the problem for the drivers, so they know exactly where to go, and also for riders, because they know exactly where they're going to end up meeting their driver. So this works for airports, that's great. But how can we make this model work outside of airports? There's lots of places that are also difficult to get picked up. We want to scale this globally. So one idea is we could just go to the city team and be like, hey, can you go to every building in your city and just like tell us exactly where you should get picked up? And the answer would probably be no, because that would be a ton of work, and that's super crazy. And like no one human knows what every, you know, every pickup location is for every building. So not going to work. We could do that, actually. That's a good idea. Maybe we'll circle back afterwards. So that's probably not going to work. So we also could do is we could, next slide. We could just take the address of a given place and try to and move the pin to that road. So for example, Leverett House is located on 28 DeWolf Street. We could say, okay, for Leverett House, let's just find the closest point on 28 on DeWolf Street and just have our pickups happen there. And for Love, this actually would be a pretty decent pickup spot. You know, DeWolf's a pretty chill space. There's a sidewalk. It's pretty good. But this sometimes breaks. So you look at Grendel's. Grendel's is a bar in the square, just down the street. You may have been there if you're over 21. And one of the problems with Grendel's is that their address is on 89 Winthrop Street, which is this road right here. But Winthrop Street at this point is not car friendly. In fact, it's actually a walking path. So if we start sending cars to Winthrop Street, 89 Winthrop Street, we're going to start running over people, which is like really bad for people and for Uber. And I'd probably get fired. So we need something else that works. Well, the data we have at our disposal is we have all this GPS data from all these trips that are happening. So okay, we could look at all of our trips and say, let's intuit based on, you know, where people tend to get picked up, what's a good location. And if you do it like at Leverett, this is Leverett, it actually looks okay. Like you can see there's some clusters here around the side entrance. There's a little bit of there's a cluster here by the main entrance. It's decent. Like you might be able to intuit something from this. But you go back to Grendel's, our problem case, and if you plot the same data, this is all from a week. There's just so many trips happening around Grendel's. It's such a popular area. There's a ton of popular bars and restaurants there. It's kind of hard to gather signal from all of this. So we try another approach. We look and we filter points only by trips that were requested from Grendel's. So as before, we were looking at all the trips that began around Grendel's. We're only looking at trips where the person was at Grendel's and they requested. When we do that, the data is much cleaner. There's a much clearer cluster just in front of the bar, which is probably where you want to get picked up. And we can actually generate a point for the pickup right here. And so if you use the app today, if you go out to Grendel's tonight, have a beer, and request an Uber home, you will see these points. And they're available for all types of locations all over the world. You go back to Lev, kind of run the same filter. It also simplifies the data, generates a much cleaner cluster. And if you see in prod today or in production, when you open up the app, you'll actually see we found spots that are in alignment with Leverett's doors, which is actually pretty cool. Like we went walking around the other day because we haven't been leaving back since this was launched, and we were like, "Oh my gosh!" Like our spots are like at the door at Leverett, which is so cool. Like we didn't even tell the system; it just learned that based on the trips that were naturally occurring there, which is pretty cool. Now, this approach is actually really important for what we call nested POIs, and these are really common, especially in big cities. And what this is essentially it's a building. That has multiple places within that building. So for example, the building that we're in has multiple offices. The example here is the Charles Hotel. The Charles Hotel is a very fancy hotel in Cambridge. Maybe some of you have been there, your parents have stayed there. And it's a big complex. And within that complex is the main hotel, and these are all the request points for that hotel. And you can see that, you know, most people are requesting at the front of the hotel. Next slide. And most of the trips, which are in green, are beginning at the front of the hotel. There's a massive cluster here, which is telling you, which makes sense. Like most trips at the hotel will happen at the front door of the hotel. But also in this complex is Legal Seafood, which is a little seafood restaurant, pretty fancy.
Maybe also a David favorite.
Also a David Malan favorite. Your professors might take you there sometime. And it's kind of nestled in the back of this complex. Well, if you go to the next slide, if you look at the trips that start from this location or where the requests happen, the trips mostly start over in this section. So you probably want to have a pickup spot over on University Road, which is actually where the front door of Legal Seafoods is. But if you use both sets of data, like the number of trips at the Charles, it's a much bigger location, a much more popular spot, are going to totally outweigh what happens at Legal Seafood. So you're probably only going to generate one spot, and it's going to be at the front of the Charles. Which is bad if you're eating at Legal Seafood, and you're like old, and you like can't get to walk through the whole hotel to get there. It's just like super ideal. So by filtering by request location, we're actually able to generate different points for each spot. If you go to the next slide. So this is actually, again, a sample from the live app. If you're at Legal Seafoods, we're going to send you to University, which is great, because that's where the front door is. And if we're at the Charles Hotel, we're going to send you to Bennett Street, because that's where their front door is. So we're essentially able to like crowdsource and learn where these entrances and exits are based on user behavior, which is pretty cool. So that being said, there are so many ways we can make these pickup points better, and we're working on. One of the things I think a lot about right now is how to refresh these and keep these new and up to date, because as the real world changes, we have to be dynamic and change with it. So as road construction happens or building goes under remodeling, we need to be able to adjust quickly so that our riders too can meet their drivers in a reasonable place.
Cool. So we just talked just about the space of that time between opening up the requesting a car and all the things that happen. But as you can imagine, beyond that, there's a lot more that needs to happen. So once you request a car, everything that happens in between that and you getting in a car, there's many, many more problems. So it's an example, just to go through some of them quickly. You know, how do we compute accurate ETAs that are aware of real-time traffic? Right? This is a thing that actually annoys riders the most, when ETAs are either wrong or they fluctuate. You know, we have another problem of making sure that the car positions are actually accurate and in real time. And there's a lot of interesting problems around how to deal with stale data when we lose connectivity or the driver loses connectivity. There's another question of how we get riders to be at the curb exactly when the driver arrives. And so we have a class of maybe some lazy riders who don't actually leave their dorms or leave their rooms until the car actually arrives. And that produces a different kind of problem because the driver has to pull over. And there's an entire side of the driver experience that we haven't even touched. And I now work on the driver experience, and this is definitely the most stressful thing. It's much more stressful for the driver to actually get a rider picked up. And then there's this last 50-meter problem where riders and drivers might not be able to find each other because it's a really dark area or because it's really crowded. And so as an example, this is where we've developed technology like this, where a rider can choose a color of their liking, and a light that's attached to the windshield, which we call beacon, lights up in that way. So in a dark venue or when it's really crowded, this might be helpful. But you know, there are a lot of these different problems around the pickups, and there's a lot more problems outside of it too. We're going to stay and talk about a lot about go through some Q&A at the end, but really encourage you to ask us a lot of questions and come work with us on these problems. And for that, I'm going to turn it over to Ali, who's going to talk a little bit about what it's like to work at Uber.
So my name is Ali Reedy. I'm a university recruiter at Uber. Been with Uber for a little bit, about two and a half years now. Started out the university team, or university in general, is fairly new at Uber. It's only been around for about 2.5 years. So we kind of helped build this program from the ground up. So gonna tell you a little bit about Uber in general, some of the opportunities that we do have available. As I mentioned, we will have a Q&A at the end, as well as we'll stay after and answer any questions that you may have one-on-one as well. So you can have a huge impact, obviously, if you join Uber. More people earn income from Uber than any other privately held company other than McDonald's or Walmart, which is pretty crazy. You can improve cities and communities. So obviously, we have seen fewer cars on the road, more like decreases of congestion and things like that. It also frees up parking garages, real estate, and business and residential space. I would say one thing that we're extremely proud of is that we are making cities safer. So 11% decrease in DUI-related car accidents after it launched in Seattle, which is pretty crazy, and I think we've been seeing it in a lot of cities, other cities as well. There's also been a 20% lower crime rate related just to, you know, transportation such as, like, you know, maybe your traditional taxis or things like that once we launched in Chicago. So same thing, we've seen that in a bunch of other cities as well, which is awesome. I think the cool part of that is, like, if you are taking Uber, you know who you're getting in the car with, you know where your payment is going, and you know that the trip that you're taking. So it has reduced in that type of way as well. How many of you guys have heard of ATG, or Advanced Technology Group? Yeah? Awesome. So that is obviously new to Uber. We are investing in the future with self-driving technology. ATG, like I said, is also known as Advanced Technology Group. I would say most of our team sits in Pittsburgh, but a lot of them have recently moved to San Francisco to work on this type of technology, which is awesome. Uber Eats, how many have used Uber Eats? Yeah? Awesome. I use it like every day. It's amazing. But we've expanded to 31 more college campuses since August, which has been crazy. It says with a $1 billion run rate in October 2016, and we do hope to get to about $10 billion within the next year or so. Some engineering locations that we do have. Our headquarters is obviously in San Francisco. We do have three offices there, actually all about 15 minutes walking-wise from each other. So we recently have opened a new office in Palo Alto, which has been around for about 6 to 8 months now. We have 1,700 engineers and growing total in those locations. Seattle, New York, and Colorado have a little bit less. Seattle is actually one of our most growing offices in the United States. There are about 130 engineers now, but we'll have quite a few in the next few months or so. New York is a little bit smaller, same with Colorado. Our Colorado office is fairly tiny, and they mostly work on our maps teams. Here's just a general list of some of our engineering teams that we do have available at Uber. Business intelligence platform, consumer products, core infrastructure, maps, marketplace and real-time systems, security, and then Uber for Business. Like I said, this is just a few general teams that we have at Uber. We do have a lot more within these larger groups. Obviously, you want to belong to a place, and you want to make sure that you are involved in other groups, when you do join the real world. So here's just a few of our groups that we do have at Uber. If you were to do an internship or even be a full-time employee, you can join these groups. If you were an intern, we do host ERG, which is also known as employee resource groups. We do have like networking nights with these groups. So Los Ubers, Women of Uber, Parenting at Uber, Shalom, Uber Pride. This is a photo of our Uber Pride parade that was held in San Francisco. It's a very fun event that Uber does. And we have a lot more. This is just to name a few. I would say we definitely have a lot of great benefits and perks at Uber as well. So as a full-time employee, you will be receiving full benefits, so medical, health, dental, vision, etc. We do have free breakfast, lunch, and dinner Monday through Friday. I would say breakfast is more of a cold breakfast where we have like yogurt, an egg, cereal, bagels, etc. Lunch and dinner are catered. There is different meals every day. You will be receiving a certain amount of monthly Uber credits per month, which is awesome. It's probably my most favorite perk at Uber, and I would say, like living in San Francisco, Uber is life. I don't think we'd be able to get over the Big Hills or walk, anywhere in the city without Uber. So using these credits is awesome. If you do run out of your credits, you still receive a certain percentage each month as well. You will be receiving a monthly stipend for your phone bill. We do have unlimited paid time off, so also known as vacation. I think that's an awesome perk too. I don't think you really realize like how valuable a day off is once you hit the real world. So as long as you have manager approval, you should be good to go. Paid time off during the holidays, I think we're about 11 or 12, I want to say, paid time off holidays throughout the year. We do a lot of volunteer events, just in San Francisco, New York, Seattle, Austin, I know has done a few, Atlanta as well. So. That's some of our other offices. If you are interested in applying, you can go to this link. This link will basically show you some of the roles that we have available. If you're interested in a specific role and it's maybe not posted on that page, feel free to come talk to me afterwards. I'm more than happy to talk with anybody about the interview process, kind of what we look for and things like that. We can do a quick Q&A and then we will stay around for about 20, 25 minutes afterwards if you have any questions.
Cool. Do you guys have any questions about either Uber, some of the material, whatever? We're down to ask us anything, I guess.
San Francisco, tech in general.
So this might not really be what you guys covered, but I was doing research on Uber, and you were doing something about electric flying cars in terms of Uber Elevate, and I was wondering how could we get involved in that if we want to work with Uber.
Got it. So the question for those of you online was about our flying cars initiative, Uber Elevate, and how to get more involved. I mean, it's really still a nascent effort, and it's just part of the whole, you know, being part of the narrative of how we move people around, and that is definitely a future possibility. And so it's for that reason that we're involved in those kinds of efforts. And you know, at the moment, it's really just trying to figure out who the players are in the you know, in the world who are in this space, and talking to them and figuring out what model is right. So it's just super small right now. And if you come to Uber, there's certain opportunities to, you know, to work with that team, to get to know that team. And I think that's the best way to do it. But I think we'll find out more as we learn more about the technology, honestly. Yeah.
You guys talked about like two from when someone requests a ride to when they get in the car. There's also this other step of matching. Like there's this like two-sided matching problem that you have to solve. Do you guys rely, like, can you maybe talk about, you talk about features figuring in your algorithms, like are there any interesting features you guys use in that respect besides like distance from driver to rider?
Sure. The question was about matching and what are the kind of the things that we do to make intelligently match riders and drivers, as well as riders and riders in the case of Uber Pool. I worked a little bit on Uber Pool, so this can speak to it. I think fundamentally, you know, it's one big optimization problem, right? And in the case of Uber Pool, for example, we're trying to find riders that can overlap, whose journey overlaps most with you. And that's what economically makes sense for us, because the greater the overlap, that means that we're actually being really efficient. And so the objective function there effectively is keeping all car seats populated any given time. And so that's kind of what we're striving for. And there are some interesting nuances around, for example, how long, if we increase the window for matching, as an example, then it increases our likelihood of being able to, you know, produce a better match. But that might mean that you might, you know, there's a match that comes in and that's available, but you might predict that you'll, in 10 seconds, come up with a better match, so you might just discard it and wait for the next one. So it's this game of probability. And so I think, you know, and those are experiments that we do on the rider and driver side as well. You know, sometimes we just tell you in the app today that, okay, a car is on the way and you have a 2-minute ETA, but you're not assigned a car until a little bit later. And that's to give us a little bit of breathing room to find the most optimal thing. So there are some tricks like that we use. And certainly many, many other factors that go into figuring out what the best optimal route is.
I think the other major component to like how we're going to actually perform that match, and there's tons of features go into making that decision. One of the major ones is time. So we look and see what is the time it's going to take for a car to get to a given rider, because we want to minimize that time as much as we can for all the pickups. So your pickup quality increases and your wait time is reduced. And we also want to minimize the time that drivers spend going to pick you up, right? Because we want the driver to have, for as much of their time as they're online at Uber, to have their car be full of drivers with passengers, that they're making money going from point A to point B. And so if they're spending more time driving to a pickup, they're spending less time earning. So we're also definitely trying to optimize around like making most effective use of that time. And then there's a whole other component on top of that time, which has to do with like the market. There's a lot of complexity with like the pricing of the marketplace itself, which is, I think, more outside of both of our domains. There's an entire team that just focuses. It takes these various inputs and then performs that optimization, comparing both like time and also like how we're choosing to spend basically like the driver's time, and also spend the amount that we're paying the driver and what the estimated fare we're receiving from the rider. So those are the components that are at play, and it's kind of constantly changing how the optimization is being performed, and it varies also by product. That's a really good question.
I was wondering if you guys can talk a little bit more personally to your roles as product managers and maybe how that works on a day in, day out basis, perhaps even compared to like a software engineering role, if you guys have any experience with that.
I'll start. So the question was, can we describe a bit like what it's like to work as a product manager and maybe compare it with like an IC role, like a software engineer? So my experience at Uber and actually at other companies as well, I worked at Google before, like a typical like setup for a team structure is you're going to have, you know, a product manager, a group of software engineers, data science, and if you're working on a product that has like some sort of experience component, like a designer and maybe a user researcher. And the product manager in this sense is really this kind of the glue of this group, right? You're working to kind of leverage the skills that each person brings to the table and try to like effectively move towards some shared vision utilizing those skills. So there's a really tactical component, just like day-to-day, making sure that those folks are all working together and like things are being unblocked and they're done on time. They're kind of like project managing. But then at a high level, you're also helping to develop like what's like the thing that we all should be working on? What's that vision for this group? And that's really where you're kind of taking input both from your team and from like, outside of industry, from research, to help craft what you're doing long term. So it's a very, you have to wear both hats, and I think the best product managers do both of those things. But it's fun because you get to be in the weeds, but you also get to be kind of like high level. Yeah. That's my take on it.
Yeah, the way I think about some of the distinctions is ultimately for a product manager is responsible for the why. Why are we doing this? Why should we invest in this? You know, the what comes from many parts of the company. Like, there are ideas floating around everywhere. And in terms of the how, that's some of the places where the engineers are really involved in and designers and figuring out exactly how we're solving this particular solution or problem. But it's the product manager to decide what problem we're solving in the first place. So that's one thing. And even in the pickup space, you know, the pickups, a good bad pickup is a problem. But maybe you know, our jobs might be to break that down into specific areas, like what part of the pickup is the problem, and then you know, apply our team to figure out solutions for it. So that's kind of one way I think about it.
Individual contributor, yeah, working like as a component to that team, as opposed to like being a manager. Some of the differences are like when you are an IC, like your product space is or your problem space is a little bit more defined. You spend more of your time obviously on your own, not in meetings, just like working on that problem, you know, writing code or whatever, do performing analyses, whatever you might be doing. So it's a lot more like you're spending your time with fewer people and more with like an idea and with tools. Whereas when you're a PM, like we spend a lot more of our time with people and kind of talking and writing things, clarifying, like writing documents and like clarifying kind of roadmaps and why you're doing things. So you spend more time with like ideas and people as opposed to like with tools. So it's just a different way of spending time, but then they're both satisfying, and the skills you if you work you know in an IC capacity like you know as an engineer, those skills are totally transferable to management and backwards and forwards.
Yeah. And then to answer your second part of the question, how it's different from a place like Google, or I also worked at Microsoft, I would say the biggest thing is the operational nature of Uber's work. So for example, we experimented a couple years ago with and this is still part of the experience today. In New York, getting people to walk to the corner, street corners, right? And that that would be more efficient. So cars can go up and down avenues instead of you know driving all over the place. And so that's the kind of thing where we need to work with the local team on the ground to make sure that you know everyone understands what's happening. They might have to change their support flows, or they might be getting a lot of inbound about it. And so there's this aspect of this physical world and the team on the ground that you have to be really thinking about, which is very different at Uber. I felt that at Microsoft or Google, you could kind of do this all remotely and manage it, and it's fine. So that's one big difference. And another one is just the size, right? You know, Uber is a big company now, but even then, it still feels like a startup. And one of the things about that is, as a product manager, you're responsible for your team and how well they're doing and how they're feeling. All these other aspects of even like recruiting and things like that. That you know you're giving a much larger responsibility, so that's something I felt as I've transitioned from different companies.
So like over the last few years, we've just kind of been transitioning from like this scrappy startup that's disrupting a massive space to like a more established company, kind of as you were touching on briefly. I'm kind of curious how things are changing kind of like structurally, like relationship and like flows between engineers to management. Like what the individual's role looks like now, and like someone for someone like me who's trying to potentially like get a position right out of college.
Right.
How has that changed over the last few years, and how does it project to change?
Sure.
So the question was about Uber as a company. It's becoming bigger and growing, and how you know the dynamics of the workplace changes the result of that, and what it's like as an individual contributor working within that kind of environment. So I can take that a part of it. So I think. Yeah, it's definitely true. When Matt and I joined, we were about 2,000 people, and now we're like 15,000, right? And so that definitely changes a lot of things. And you know, it's certainly the case that you know we kind of have real-world responsibilities now. We can't just launch something in some random city, not tell anyone, and that kind of thing happened a lot when there were a lot of these autonomous teams, right? So there is a certain aspect of we do need to be talking with each other and communicating, and there certainly needs to be some process in place, or you know, even a marketing campaign that one city runs, like actually, you know, people need to know it because it could affect many other people, right? Mm-hmm. You could have competing policies, all these kinds of things. So there's the reality that as we grow bigger and we have millions of riders and millions of drivers whose lives we're supporting, we actually have to put some process in place. So for that, I think there's a little bit more of the checks and balances that are necessary. But I think part of ESSER growing that's we're really conscious of is making sure that everyone still feels that sense of autonomy. And I think the way we're organized is actually a good way that facilitates that, which is if you're in a team, let's say there's a team called the Pickup Experience, and their sole mission is to make the pickup great. And so they actually have a full stack set of engineers across, you know, both Android and iOS, as well as deep inside the mapping stack. There's, you know, a person on ops, product manager, designers, data scientists, and they basically have the expertise to make this happen without creating too many more dependencies. So that's kind of how Uber is organized in terms of like teams around these missions that can execute on their own, you know, on their own. And so the setup has this autonomy, and it's really then just a matter of making sure that there's a process around that in terms of communication where, you know, we're all talking, so it's not all these silos. So it's definitely a delicate balancing act. And I would say that one of the interesting things right now of joining is that you're in this kind of like gray space where we're trying to figure out what the most effective way to do this is, and kind of contributing to that process. You know, for example, at a place like Google, you know, they have everything figured out. So there's like this launch process that's like, you know, it's quite sophisticated. But you know, maybe that's not the right approach for Uber, and we're still trying to figure out. And that's part of, you know, what it means to come work at Uber.
I think the one other thing to consider too is, like, especially as a recent grad, is the kind of mentorship you're going to get and the kind of experiences you're going to have when you're taking on that first job. And I think one of the benefits of Uber kind of growing over the past few years and now, you know, having doubled and tripled in size since we joined is that there, I think, is more people to actually mentor and like to help people grow. You know, in the earlier days, you kind of showed up and it was like, all right, figure out how to make this thing work, and there's no one who's going to really hold your hand, and it's kind of like, you know, a lot of figuring out on your own, and which is fine. That's a way to grow. But from my experience, like having come from Google, like it was really nice to be in a place where like there was like a layer of management who were like people who were a few years older than me who could like teach me how to do X, Y, and Z and kind of help me hone my own skills. And I think as we're maturing as a company, we're getting to a place where we have those people. People have time to be able to like, you know, take on recent grads and hire and help train them and like onboard them and stuff. So. And that is a really important part of any first job, which is having that mentorship. And I think that's something that we now are able to offer, which is really cool.
I saw a question in this area before.
I guess, how does internships work at Uber? And what do you look for in an intern?
Sucks. I'm the one next. You can stand next to me.
Okay. you asked, the question was, what is an intern? The internship program like, and what do we look for in an intern, correct?
Yes.
So I'll tell you a little bit about our internship program in general. So typically it's about a 12 to 16 week internship, depending on maybe which school you go to. We do hire interns year round. So we have, I would say our biggest intern class is obviously in the summer, but then we do have a fall intern class. I believe our fall intern class is about 35 interns right now. And then in the spring, it's roughly about the same, too. Over summer, we probably have about 180 and growing. So there's obviously a lot more, you know, intern events and things like that during the summer. So that's the program itself. There's a few different internships, obviously, that we have available. So if you are looking for, like, a software engineer internship, basically what will happen is you will interview as a generalist, and what will happen is that we will allocate you to a team most likely about 3 months prior to starting. And the reason we do that is just because Uber is constantly changing organizing teams, things like that. So we'll allocate you to a team 3 months prior. You actually get to choose your team too. We typically give you a survey of about 20 to 25 teams that you can choose from. I would say most interns did get their top two this year. If they didn't get their top two, it was maybe because like they wanted Uber Eats and they wanted Palo Alto. Uber Eats isn't in Palo Alto, so they had to work in San Francisco. So things like that. Everybody loves having an intern, which is awesome. you had an intern.
Yeah, So I work on the routing team, like the Maps like routing team, and we have had like the most phenomenal interns, like kind of every quarter or every semester. You would be amazed. We also worked at Google, so I've had interns at other companies too, but you'd be amazed the things at Uber, like the interns build, like things that you've all used in the app. Like interns have totally built, maybe they've launched within their internship, which just like blows my mind. Because I mean, other bigger companies, it's hard to ramp up in 3 months and actually ship something. But like we have people contributing, interns contributing like really amazing features to the app. So yeah, I've been blown away by some of our interns, and most of them come back now. Some of them are still in school, but cool.
That's one of the things I always tell our interns as well. Like if you're looking to make an impact at a company and you're looking to like work on meaningful work and you're looking to like work on a project that really interests you, then like Uber is probably the place to be. If you're looking for an internship that's like, I don't really feel like working today, or I want, you know, fun all day long, that probably isn't the place for you. And we've done a pretty good job at making sure that each intern works on different projects that impact the company. Like Matt was just saying, like we've had a few interns like work on projects that have been implemented into the entire company. I think we've had like an intern speak at like our all hands meetings about the type of project that they worked on within a 12-week span. So I wouldn't say we look for any specific things. I would say we really are looking for like passion, and looking for somebody who wants to learn and who wants to grow their career. From most of my interns that I've had over like the past like 2.5 years, I would say majority of them have said like this is the most challenging internship they've had because they have never learned so much within a 12-week span. So that's the program.
You're basically treated like a full-time employee.
You are
treated. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I'm actually asking for my little brother. Do you guys do freshman interns, like after freshman year?
We do.
Do you guys
freshman
do?
Friendly.
Cool. Do you guys draw a clear distinction between like product managers and individual contributors, or is there an opportunity to do both?
Okay, so yeah, the question was about product managers and individual contributors. I think individual contributors in that context is a little bit of a misnomer. It's product managers are individual contributors too in some ways. It's just so happens that you're kind of like working with many people, right? And so that's the primary distinction. But you know, there are definitely managers of engineers, managers of product managers, and things like that. So you know, especially off the bat, you know, everyone's essentially an individual contributor. Yeah. Cool. All right. Well, we'll stick around, but thanks for showing up. Yeah.